Chapter 29. Madagascar, Indian Ocean. Africa again, Sam muttered, pulling the Range Rover to a stop off the dirt road. He shut off the engine and set the parking brake. Had to be Africa.
Don't let the locals hear you say that, Remy replied. We're 300 miles off the African coast. As far as these folks are concerned, Madagascar's a world unto itself.
Sam raised his hands in surrender. He knew she was right. Their marathon San Diego, Atlanta, Johannesburg, Antananarivo route had given them plenty of time to read up on Madagascar. They climbed out, walked to the rear of the rover, and began gathering their gear. The identity of the map inside Blaylock's walking staff had remained a mystery for only a few hours as Pete and Wendy scoured the vast cartographical databases the Fargos had acquired over the years. As it turned out, the map in question was but a section of a larger chart penned by a French explorer named Moreau in 1873, some 23 years after France's armed annexation of the island. The partial word in the upper left-hand corner was, in fact, prunes, French for plums, the name given by an explorer to a series of atolls along the coast. From there, Pete and Wendy had had little trouble matching up the river names and isolating the section of coastline in question. What remained a mystery, however, was why Madagascar had been so important to Blaylock. It was a question Sam and Remy hoped to answer while Selma, the Wonder Twins, and Julianne Severson at the Library of Congress continued to dissect and analyze Blaylock's journal, his letters to Constance Ashworth, and the newly named Orizaga Codex. For their part, aside from a current topographical chart, all Sam and Remy had to go on was a laminated copy of the Moreau map and an enlargement of the area around the miniaturized annotation, which they'd matched to Blaylock's handwriting that Pete had discovered penned over a cove in the coastline. Having grown accustomed to Blaylock's penchant for thought fragments, they'd been unsurprised to find the jot consisted of only 7 words. 1442 spans 315 degrees. Into the lion's mouth. The fourth largest island in the world, Madagascar, was in many ways a world apart. For instance, it was home to 5% of the world's plant and animal species. Of these, 80% were found nowhere else on Earth. Lemurs of every stripe and size, cave-dwelling crocodiles, carnivorous plants and spitting beetles, and giant centipedes, 32 species of chameleon, 202 species of birds, and an array of baobab trees that seemed plucked from the mind of a science fiction movie director. And for all that, not a single endemic poisonous snake called the island home. Madagascar's history was no less unique. While the island's official history began in the 7th century with Bantus using encampments along Madagascar's northern tip as trading posts for passing Arab merchants, archaeological finds in recent decades had to probe deeper, suggesting Madagascar's first settlers had arrived from Sulawesi in Indonesia between 200 and 500 CE. Over the next 1,100 years, Madagascar became the melting pot of Africa, populated mostly by Portuguese, Indian, Arabic, and Somalian settlers, until the age of exploration arrived and the scramble for Africa began. European colonial powers and pirates alike rushed to Madagascar, and the island saw a series of ruling dynasties until the late 18th century, when the Marina family managed, with the help of the British, to gain control of most of the island in a hegemony that ended almost a century later with France's invasion in 1883 and what became known as the Franco-Hova War. In 1896, France annexed Madagascar, and the Marina royal family was exiled to Algeria. They gave their gear a once-over, then donned their packs before standing back to take in the scenery. The drive from the Antananarivo airport had taken them east on Route 2 and down from the central highlands that ran roughly north to south down the island spine to where they stood, the coastal lowlands, a 2-mile-wide ribbon of rainforest and ravine-laden terrain buttressed by 1,500-foot escarpments interlaced with waterfalls.
At their back was the Canal de Pangalan, a 500-mile-long chain of natural and man-made lakes and coves connected by canals. It was in this section of the Pangalan that they hoped to find the spot Blaylock had indicated with his cryptic notation. From there, it would be only a matter of pacing off 1,442 spans, which they assumed and hoped referred to Blaylock's staff, on a compass bearing of 315 degrees and looking for a lion's mouth into which they could leap or stare or whatever Blaylock had in mind. The problem was, Moreau, the author of the map, had clearly missed cartography day in explorer's school. His sense of scale and distance was nearly non-existent. Sam and Remy's exploration would have to be trial and error. It never sounded simple, Remy now said. But looking at this place... Her voice trailed off, and she shook her head in frustration. Sam nodded. The land that time forgot. In the lead, Sam stepped off the road onto what resembled a game trail, which evaporated after 100 yards, at which point he unsheathed his machete and began bushwhacking through the head-height brush. With every step, saw-toothed leaves nicked their exposed skin while spiked stems plucked at their clothing, frequently requiring them to stop to free themselves. After 30 minutes, they'd covered a quarter mile when a garage-sized clearing opened before them. Remy took a reading from their handheld GPS, looked around to get her bearings, then pointed. They set off again, Sam hacking a path while Remy navigated. 30 minutes turned into an hour. Sweat beaded on their pin-pricked skin, and their clothes became so saturated they might as well have just stepped from a swimming pool. Despite the blazing sun, each of them felt slightly chilled. After another 30 minutes, Sam stopped suddenly and held up his hand for quiet. He glanced back at Remy and tapped his nose. She nodded. Smoke. Somewhere nearby was a campfire. Then somewhere off to their left came a rustling sound. Something was moving in the underbrush. They stood stock still, barely breathing, trying to pinpoint the location. It came again, but sounded farther away. Suddenly a male voice called out, "Are you good folks lost by chance?" Sam looked back at Remy, who shrugged. Sam called back, "I wouldn't so much call it lost as serendipitous exploration." The voice chuckled. "Well, that's a first. If you feel like a break, I've got coffee on." "Sure, why not?" "Where?" "Look to your left." They did so. A moment later, the flaming tip of a branch jutted up from the undergrowth 30 feet away. "If you keep going straight for 10 or 12 more paces, you'll run into a game trail. It'll take you straight in." "On our way." 5 minutes later, they pushed their way off the trail into a clearing surrounded by dwarf baobabs. Strung between two of them was a netted hammock. In the center of the clearing, hemmed in by a pair of fallen logs for seating, a small campfire crackled. A mid-70s man with silver hair and a goatee smiled up at them. His eyes were a mischievous green. "Welcome. Have a seat." Sam and Remy shrugged off their packs and sat down on the log opposite the man. They introduced themselves. The man nodded, smiled, and said, "Everybody calls me Kid." Sam nodded at the revolver strapped to the man's hip. "Because of that?" "More or less." "A Webley?" "Good eye. Model Mark 6, .455 caliber, circa 1915. "Enough gun talk, boys," Remy said. "We appreciate the invitation. It feels we've been out there for 2 days. "In Madagascar time, that's about 2 hours. Sam checked his watch. "You're right." Sam noticed what looked like a 2-foot-high pyramid of dirt clods lying at the man's feet. "May I ask?" "Ah, these. Madagascar truffles. Finest in the world."
"Never heard of them," Remy replied.
"Most of them get sold to Japan. $1,000 a pound. Sam said, looks like you've got a few $1,000s sitting beside your boots.
Give or take.
How do you find them? Asked Remy. Smell, location, animal tracks. After 10 years, it's more a feeling than anything else.
10 years?
Not out here the whole time, I hope. The kid chuckled.
No, truffle season's only 5 weeks long. The other 47 weeks, I've got a little place on the beach near Andavaranto. Do a little fishing, a little diving, a little hiking, and a lot of staring at sunsets.
Sounds wonderful.
It is indeed, madam. What's not wonderful, however, is the nice collection of scratches there.
Sam and Remy glanced at the red crisscrosses on their arms and legs. The man reached into an old canvas backpack leaning against the log, rummaged around, and came out with an unmarked glass tube. He tossed it across to Remy.
Local recipe, the kid said. Works miracles. Just don't ask what's in it.
Sam and Remy dabbed the greenish, foul-smelling ointment on their scratches. Immediately the sting disappeared. Sam said, smells a lot like animal urine, and the kid smiled.
I told you not to ask.
He poured them each a cup of coffee from the soot-burnished percolator sitting at the edge of the fire.
So if you don't mind me asking, what are you folks doing out here?
We're looking for a spot that may or may not exist, Sam replied.
Ah, the siren song of lost lands. As it happens, imaginary places are one of my specialties.
Sam reached into the side pocket of his pack, withdrew the Moreau map, and handed it across. The kid studied it for 30 seconds, then handed it back.
Good news, bad news. Pick your poison.
Bad news, Remy replied.
You're about 80 years too late. That area of the Pangalan was swallowed up after an earthquake in 1932.
And the good news?
It's dry land now, and I can probably get you to within a few yards of the spot you seek.
They finished their coffee, then the kid kicked dirt over his fire and packed his gear, and the three of them set out with the kid in the lead, Remy in the middle, and Sam trailing. The kid required neither machete nor compass as he headed northeast, following trails that at first glance seemed like nothing more than gaps in the foliage. Despite his years, he moved at a steady, economical pace that told Sam and Remy their guide had spent more of his life out of doors than in. After 40 minutes of walking in companionable silence, the kid called over his shoulder,
"This place you're looking for, what's so special about it?"
Remy glanced back at Sam with a questioning look on her face. Sam gave it a moment's thought, then replied,
"You strike me as an honest man, kid. Am I wrong about that?"
The kid stopped walking and turned around. He smiled.
"You're not wrong. I've kept more confidences than steps I've taken."
Sam held his gaze for a few moments, then nodded.
"Lead on, and we'll tell you a story."
The kid turned around and started walking again. Sam said, "Have you ever heard of the CSS Shenandoah?" After another hour, the underbrush began to thin out, and they soon found themselves surrounded by savanna dotted with clusters of baobab. A mile to their left, the grassland again gave way to rainforest that rose to meet the escarpment, while to their right they could see the Canal de Pangalan. Beyond that, the blue of the Indian Ocean. They stopped walking and took a water break. After a gulp from his canteen, the kid said,
"So this Blaylock fella, he sounds like quite a character."
Remy nodded. "The problem is, we still don't know how much of his story is real, and how much is malaria and grief-induced fantasy."
"That's the blessing and the curse of adventure," the kid replied. "As far as I'm concerned, one should never miss the chance to take the road less traveled."
Sam smiled and held up his canteen.
"Cheers to that."
They clicked canteens.
"Why don't you two take a break? I'm going to do some scouting.
I think we're close, but I need to do some checking around. The kid dropped his pack and walked off through the knee-high grass. Sam and Remy plopped down on the ground and listened to the waves crashing on the beach. A cluster of rainbow-hued butterflies drifted across the tops of the grass, fluttered above their heads for a few moments, then continued on. From a nearby baobab, a ring-tailed lemur hung upside down, staring at them. After 2 minutes of this, he slowly climbed up and out of view. Without a sound, the kid reappeared behind them.
"Eureka," he simply said.
It was a 5-minute walk away. As they topped a small, steep-sided hillock, the kid stopped and spread his hands.
"Here?" Sam asked.
"Here. After the earthquake, the cove closed up and the water evaporated, leaving just the upper part of the island exposed. 80 years of ocean silt and storms filled in the depression." Sam and Remy looked around. Thankfully, the hillock measured no more than 400 square feet. Remy said, "I suppose we find the center point and start walking." The kid asked, "How many spans did Blaylock indicate?"
1,442, a little under 2 miles.
The kid checked the sky.
"In Madagascar time, that's 3 or 4 hours, most of it back in the rainforest. My recommendation? We settle in for the night."